Doug Keller on behalf of amicus, who this court appointed to support the appellant, Mr. Taylor. The parole officials in this case have not met their heavy burden to establish their entitlement to absolute immunity, and that's because they failed to provide this court with sufficient information to analyze the rigorous three-part test this court used to determine whether a government official is entitled to quasi-judicial immunity. To begin with, they failed to establish that the D.C. parole process contains adequate procedural safeguards that obviate the need for private damages suits to deter unlawful conduct. The D.C. parole process is missing five procedural protections, protections whose existence the Supreme Court has identified as particularly important in this context. First, and I think most importantly, unlike ALJs and unlike judges, U.S. parole commissioners are not independent adjudicators. They are entirely beholden to a politician, the president, and can be fired at any time and for any reason. Now, the government doesn't contest that. Instead, they merely claim that Mr. Taylor hasn't established that political pressure is exerted in practice. But the burden is on the government, not Mr. Taylor. And this court can't simply assume on an empty record that that political pressure is not exerted in practice.
Well, why was it okay to grant absolute immunity to prosecutors? They can be fired by the president without any notice, cause, et cetera.
Right. Well, I think prosecutors are a separate category because ultimately a litigant who's wronged by a prosecutor typically can appeal to a district court or a federal judge.
Same as here too. If the parole guidelines are applied unconstitutionally, you can appeal. And in fact, he has. And if we were to hold that they were unconstitutionally applied, then it would go back and this would be habeas, and he could be released. Why is that different?
Well, there's no internal right to appellate review.
Internal right to appellate review in the if a prosecutor decides to prosecute somebody for a political reason either.
Well, there's immediate review, presumably to the district court and then up to the appellate process.
And why isn't there the same here?
Well, here it's different because at best all Mr. Taylor would have without a 1983 action is habeas, and habeas is a limited remedy as this case shows.
It's limited, but if it really is as clear as you say, for this kind of constitutional violation, it's limited, but it is a violation.
Sure, it's limited, but the question here isn't just does Mr. Taylor have another remedy. There is a strong presumption against providing government officials with absolute immunity, and so the question here is, are parole officials part of that special group of people who should be entirely immune from...
I'm asking you to distinguish it from the prosecutor point of view. I mean, it's very difficult, needless to say. I don't know in fact, I personally don't have any cases where a court has said that the prosecutor acted for political reasons, and for that reason alone, we're going to dismiss the case. Now, that is certainly within the court's power, but it's very difficult to prove. Instead, you have to find that there is no violation of the law, as the prosecutor alleged. And similarly here, you would go into habeas and you'd say they applied the wrong guidelines and they applied them in an unconstitutional way.
Sure, but I think typically with prosecutors, there is going to be the protection of a court system. There's just a more robust procedural protections in a typical court proceeding in direct review as opposed to habeas, which is limited. But I think at the end of the day, it is true that this wouldn't be Mr. Taylor's only opportunity. But again, the starting presumption is that we typically don't take off private damages suits off the table. And so it's only a question of...
Well, what about the lawyers, the civil lawyers in the Butts case who also got absolute immunity? It'd be pretty hard. I mean, it would take quite a while before that could be challenged in court. And they were certainly removable at the will of the secretary.
But only for cause.
I'm not talking about the ALJs. I'm talking about the lawyers who presented the arguments to the ALJs. They also got absolute immunity.
Well, ultimately, their immunity rises and falls under the procedural process inherent in the system. And so, again, the litigants in the administrative process are protected by adjudicators who are independent and are independent from the political process. So in that sense, litigants in that process had more robust procedural protections, which is what the court primarily focused on in Butts, was that the adjudicators were independent. And you see the converse situation.
It wasn't the only thing. It was, or even primary is one of three things, right? The functional equivalence was more. If you had, This was only the third. The safeguards was really only the third thing. I don't know. Sometimes you save the best for last. Sometimes you don't. But it's hard to say it was the most important.
Well, part of the reason why they weren't functionally comparable to judges is, I'm sorry, part of the reason why they were functionally comparable to judges was because they were independent adjudicators. And you see the converse situation in Clevenger, where the adjudicators there were not independent.
Clevenger's not very helpful to you because the Supreme Court specifically separated out the parole commissioners and described them as the board is a neither do we equate this discipline committee membership to service upon a traditional parole board. The board is a neutral and detached hearing body. The parole board has been described as an impartial professional serving essentially as an arm of the sentencing judge. And in the penalty context, the parole board is constitutionally required to provide greater due process protection than is the institution discipline committee.
Well, a few things. I think all the court was saying there is that it is true that in Clevenger, the adjudicators weren't independent from the litigants. They were going to be adjudicating disputes between their coworkers and another prisoner. And that's not true in the parole context. But it is true in the parole context that the adjudicators aren't independent in a different way. They're not independent from the political process. And I think it's important to note that in Clevenger, the court told us that case wasn't a close case, that there would be close cases, but that wasn't one of them. And I think there are a couple other factors that make our case better than Clevenger. The first is that at least in Clevenger, prisoners had three levels of administrative review. That's not true here. They have none. The second is the passage of the PLRA in 1996. That's dramatically reduced the amount of frivolous prisoner litigation. So parole commissioners now are less likely to be targeted by harassing lawsuits because of Congress's action in 1996. And I think both of those factors make this a better case than Clevenger, even if Clevenger is stronger on the independence of the adjudicator.
Why does the independence matter for immunity?
Well, I think ultimately we're trying to determine if the process is likely to come to an accurate result and not be influenced by outside factors. So
influenced by the president?
The president or presumably.
You know, I guess that's odd, and I realize the Supreme Court has hinted at this, as Judge Garland pointed out, as one of the factors in the cases, but it seems somewhat odd that your immunity would become less if the president was more involved.
Well, I guess the idea is that the president or presumably his subordinates.
Assumes the president is putting inappropriate pressure on the decision maker.
I think that's right, and I think it's, since this is the parole context, we can certainly imagine situations where.
Do you think that makes sense?
I'm sorry?
Do you think that makes sense?
I do, because I think parole decisions can be politically controversial. If the parole board decides to release a prisoner who goes out and commits a heinous crime, that can cause a political controversy.
The Constitution gives the president the full pardon power, completely unreviewable.
That's right, but I don't think that changes the fact that I can certainly see parole commissioners feeling political pressure to deny parole in perhaps closed cases. And because they're not independent adjudicators in that sense, they might not follow the law. And that's why we need private damages suits to push parole commissioners to follow the law. And I think this litigation and the series of ex post facto litigation proves the point. Garner came out in 2000, set forth a fairly easy test for the parole commission to follow.
Isn't it the latter litigation that's, you lumped them together there as causing the change? Is that what you're?
Right, exactly. So we had Fletcher 2 and Fletcher 3 and Selma. It took that series of litigation for the parole commission finally to attempt to rectify the ex post facto violations that were going on in.
Well, maybe that's a good segue into your other question, which is qualified immunity. You have to establish that it's clearly established, right?
Sure. Well.
And given that this court twice and both Fletchers couldn't establish that it was clearly established, but had to remand for a determination of whether or not there was an actual violation. What's the support for the proposition that it was clearly established that there would be a violation here to apply the other guidelines?
Well, I think the law was clearly established in both Fletcher 2 and Fletcher 3. The court noted that it was clear that Garner's test applied, and then it was just a question of how the facts of those particular cases.
It's not a violation unless it is actually the case that there's a significant increase, right?
That's right.
And in neither Fletcher 1 nor Fletcher 2 could we conclude that there was, only that there was the possibility, and therefore there had to be a remand. That's accurate description.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yeah.
So how can that be clearly established if even this court, I mean, if it was clearly established, presumably this court could have just said so, apply this guideline rather than that guideline if it was so clear.
Well, I think whether there was an actual violation wasn't clear in those cases, but the question on the second prong of qualified immunity is merely, is the law clear? And I think the law is clear that they have to follow Gardner. That's the standard. And then the question is, given our particular facts, how does that come out? And
but here, it's not, the question is it a violation? When you say follow Gardner, in the end, that only means to apply the rule, the one rule rather than another if there's a significant chance that applying the wrong rule will increase the punishment, right?
Right.
So we could have said in Fletcher 1 or Fletcher 2, there is a significant chance, apply the older guideline. But we didn't say that. We said, we don't know if there's a significant chance. Now, I mean, there's a possibility, and now go ahead and look. In fact, even the Southern District of West Virginia case that you say doesn't, in that you cite, which I guess is this case in a certain way, doesn't in the end say there's a violation. It just says there's a probable violation, right?
That's correct.
So how could the parole commissioner know that it is clearly established that they must apply it?
Well, I think
if no court has been able to make that determination yet.
Well, as the Supreme Court has said, we don't need to point to an exact similar fact situation, right. But all we need to do is point to the clear legal rule. And here, Gardner provides that clear legal rule, and that should have put the parole commission on notice. They need to do the analysis under each of the two guidelines and determine at that point, is there a significant risk? And
the violation isn't not doing the analysis. The violation is the bottom line of applying the wrong regulation, isn't that right?
That's correct. But then I think the what would follow from your line of questioning is that you would need a similar fact pattern that comes out like ours, and this court says there's a significant risk. But I don't think you need a similar fact pattern. All you need to do is have the law to be clear.
But it is clear that you don't have to apply the earlier guidelines for every prisoner, right?
That's
right. It's only prisoners who are somehow in the same category. If it were true of this prisoner, are in that category. And the question is, does the court know? Just like, this is really why isn't this the problem of the level of generality? Yes, the Fourth Amendment says only reasonable searches and seizures. That's clear, absolutely. But we have to determine in some sets of categories what's reasonable and what's not. And here, there are some sets of prisoners for whom it would be okay and some for whom it would not. And it requires a pretty specific analysis to make that determination, doesn't it?
Well, a few things. I think it requires a specific analysis only in the sense that it does require a lot of work to walk through the parole guidelines, but these are parole commissioners. Presumably they can do that fairly easily and get to the bottom line of you're presumptively suitable to presumptively unsuitable and make the determination that, yes, that is in fact a significant risk. I think this is different than a lot of Fourth Amendment cases because oftentimes different fact patterns trigger different ultimate tests. There's no question here that Gardner provides the test. There's no other facts that could come out, that could change the legal standard. The legal standard is Gardner. And so I think that test put the commission on notice, certainly by Mr. Taylor's 2005 hearing when this court had already acknowledged that, yes, Gardner controls the D.C. parole guideline process. So certainly by that point, I think the commission was on notice that they had to apply Gardner and walk through the analysis.
Okay, we'll hear from the government. Thank you. We'll give you some extra time. We ate up some of your time. Lyons.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jane Lyons from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Parole Commission, its commissioners, and examiner. This case is narrowed down to the question of whether parole commissioners and examiners are entitled to absolute immunity from damages suits in connection with their performance of their official duties.
I thought there was a second question.
What's the second question?
Whether there's qualified immunity.
That would be the fallback argument. I'd like to argue that they should be afforded absolute immunity here.
Well, they're not independent in the sense that ALJs are. They can be fired at any time by the president, and perhaps just as importantly, they can be reappointed by the president. And when you're subject to reappointment by the president, memos are prepared by presidential personnel to the president that describe the substance of the person's rulings and how the person goes about his or her job. In other words, if you want to get reappointed, you're subject to review by the president? And doesn't that put pressure that's different from ALJ pressure?
I don't think in a material respect, and I think this goes to the heart of what a parole decision really is. A parole decision is an executive grant, essentially, of some form of clemency or grace. It's not, you can't be denied for unconstitutional reasons, of course, but the power is vested in the executive branch to grant or deny parole, and so...
But there are guidelines, right?
And there are guidelines, and
it
would be...
They have to, once established, they have to apply the guidelines, right?
The guidelines are applied within the discretion that the guidelines reserve to the executive to act in any case.
But if, for example, in this case, there was no discretion at the end that fell within the guideline and the person had already served beyond the guideline and the guideline itself did not provide discretion, there would be no further discretion. The president, I don't know, but I assume the president could not simply by order say, I don't like this person and you have to keep him longer than the regulations you previously promulgated, or could he?
In that extremely hypothetical case,
certainly the Attorney General couldn't do that. Let's leave the President out of this. The Attorney General couldn't say, "I don't care."
I work for the Attorney General.
So. I know, so it's I'm trying to put the point down a little harsher for you, I guess.
The executive branch can create policy and guidelines for when to grant or deny parole that can be challenged in court. What this case is about is whether the people who carry out those policies...
I think what Judge Kavanaugh is asking is what... Nothing prevents, unlike an ALJ, nothing prevents the Attorney General from firing the parole officer, the members of the board, because... doesn't like their decisions, even if their decisions are consistent with the guidelines.
I think that's correct, but I don't know why it matters. The important point is that the Supreme Court has recognized...
Well, it matters because... Because
the Supreme Court has recognized that these parole proceedings are equivalent or an extension of the sentencing function of the courts, which makes them quasi-judicial. And in that context, the Supreme Court has recognized in Butts versus Economo that the risk of an unconstitutional act is outweighed by the importance of preserving the independent judgment of the actors. And that's not, in the parole context, not independent of the executive. It's independent of pressures from things like lawsuits hanging over their heads while they're trying to do their job.
Well, in Clevenger, they just talk more generally about the term independent and say it's the old situational problem of the relationship between the keeper and the kept. Relationship that hardly is conducive to a truly adjudicatory performance.
That's right, Your
Honor.
Isn't
someone removable at will kept?
No, the Clevenger addresses...
That's what most people in the executive branch who are removable at will certainly think of themselves that way.
I know I do. Clevenger, however, addresses the very different situation. The keeper and the kept there are in the context of the prison walls. Mm-hmm. The people who are being asked to make judgments are weighing evidence between the prisoner and prison guards, and they work for the warden, and it's all, I don't want to say incestuous, but it's all within the same group. It's a very different context than an independent portion of the executive branch of the federal government making parole decisions regarding D.C. co-defenders. And the independence of the commission is much more akin to a quasi-judicial forum than the inside the prison discipline.
What about the Butts case where they talk about the independence of the ALJ as being an important factor?
It's only one of the factors.
That's not covered by this, what you just described, is it? In other words, it's not within the prison walls, obviously, in the ALJ situation.
It's slightly different. I think what's important about Butts looks first at the origins of immunity.
It says free from pressures by the parties or other officials within the agency.
Well, free from pressure from the parties would include free from pressure from the prisoner bringing a lawsuit trying to get a judge.
Right, I got that, but how about free from pressure from other officials within the agency? Because the ALJs were free from pressure from other officials within the agency, they're independent and therefore... like judges, and therefore...
Right. In this context, because the executive branch, ultimately at the highest levels, whether it's the Attorney General or the President, has the power to set the authority for granting parole, it's a different situation than judges who have life tenure and are not subject to anything other than review by a higher court.
ALJs are different from judges? Is that your point?
ALJs are different from judges in the same manner that parole
commissioners are. True, because they don't have life tenure, but they do have the protection of for-cause protection, which was important to the Supreme Court.
It's important. It's,
and then they used the term independent again in Clevenger, and maybe that can be characterized as just within the four walls of the prison, but when you look back to Butts, it seems like they're talking about something more. They're talking about political pressure as well. And I have a broader question why that matters, but it matters because they told us it matters.
They've mentioned it as a factor, and so it does matter, but I don't think it matters in this context the same way that you're trying to apply it. The rationales underlying the immunity doctrine have to do with whether, I mean, it goes back to English common law, whether the type of injury is normally compensable in damages and the need to make protect the decision-making process of the executive. And generally speaking,
the theory of these cases is a quasi-judicial actor, correct?
Yes.
Right. So
quasi-judicial.
A quasi-judicial actor who's entitled to the same immunity that judges have.
At least the same type of immunity, yes.
Right. It's not your location within the executive branch. In fact, I specifically said it's functional, not locational, correct?
Yes. Okay. That's right. And here, the parole commissioners...
When you say things like within the... I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but when you say within the executive branch, that's really not the analysis that matters. What matters is, are you entitled to quasi-judicial immunity like judges? And one key factor, or factor, is independence from political pressure. And these commissioners do not have it.
Well, only the president can fire the commissioners. I don't believe the attorney general
at will, correct?
That's
what the Office of Legal Counsel has said.
I believe it's at will. That's correct.
And they're reappointed, which is important, too, in the real world.
Yes, that's true. So what we're talking about is simply the functioning of the system and, to some extent, the prerogative of the executive in the entire system of granting parole. The only reason I keep mentioning it's in the executive branch because it's an extension of the sentencing, which is obviously a judicial function. That's all I mean to reference. The important facts here are that the parole commissioners perform quasi-judicial functions, and that puts them in a special group of people who should be afforded absolute immunity, as every federal appellate court to have examined this issue has found. There are no cases.
You have the precedent on your side. Does the Office of Legal Counsel perform a quasi-judicial function?
The Office of Legal Counsel, I am not familiar with all of the possible powers that office can exercise, so I'm not prepared.
Are there other officials in the Justice Department?
You give a lot of advisory opinions, I understand.
In that sense, I don't see them automatically, at least, as exercising a quasi-judicial role because most of their work that I'm familiar with is to give advice.
You want to talk in the remaining seconds you have left about your fallback, unless you feel incredibly confident about your first argument? Maybe you want to talk about your fallback argument.
I feel very strong about my first argument on absolute immunity. However, I am here to answer the court's questions. I believe that qualified immunity doesn't need a whole lot of time to address it anyway. Even in 2009, the district court in West Virginia called the question of whether there was an ex post facto violation a thorny question for which there is no clear consensus among authorities. So under Ashcroft, the Alkid decision, and this court's decision in Bain versus Johnson, that clearly eliminates the second prong of the, right, it satisfies the second prong for having qualified immunity.
Garner doesn't set forth a baseline principle?
Garner does not. Garner stands for the proposition that what you call the parole guidance, guidelines, whatever, that it means that it needs to be examined. It establishes a threshold that there could be an ex post facto violation, but not that there is. In Phillips versus Fullwood, in 2010, this court looked at a case involving the same argument that the Parole Commission's application of its 2000 regulations instead of the D.C. 1987 guidelines was an ex post facto violation. And once again, it wasn't clear. And here we have allegations on this record, allegations from Mr. Taylor that make it clear that he was not subject, there was no significant risk even taking his allegations as true, a significant risk of prolonging his...
Say that last part again. I thought the district judge thought there was a significant risk.
He did not do much. Did not do an analysis to speak of, Your Honor.
Really, it looked like very specific analysis. The district court in West Virginia. Didn't, I'm not talking about in our court. The West.
Right. Virginia. Oh, the district court.
Yeah. Didn't he do a pretty quite specific analysis of what the?
He said there was a parole violation based on what he saw, but nothing about that is precedential, and it's not an analysis. I mean, I have to take issue with it. It's simply incorrect. What we know is that Mr. Taylor has been reviewed for parole several times under the D.C. guidelines since 2005 and
so
has not been
Why do we not know what the result is of the last one?
Why do we not know what the result of the last one
is? Yeah, I thought he had one using the
guidelines. He's had several at this point.
Using the guidelines he wants.
Yes, and he has been denied parole each and every time.
Do we have the actual result, the explanation for why? Do we have to give an explanation, by the way?
In the joint appendix, there is one... from 2009 that the government put in as an exhibit to its motion to dismiss. This appears at JA 36. It's from a hearing in July of 2009 to demonstrate essentially that he was being considered for parole at that point under the D.C. guidelines.
JA what?
36, Your Honor.
But that's I think that may be the one I'm thinking of. That says he... Does this give the result? Or just say that he's being... I thought he had a hearing, but it didn't give... Maybe I'm wrong about that. It does actually give...
Well, it goes through giving him a score and things.
It says to review the disciplinary... the recommendation is defer decision to obtain and review the disciplinary report.
So additional information was being requested as of this time.
What's happened? Do we know?
He's still in jail.
I got that part, but do we know... do we know why that is...
Well, the most recent review that I have seen, which is not part of the record, is that he has two of the four factors under the 1987 guidelines deal with the prisoner's conduct while in prison and his adaptation. Most recently, Mr. Taylor had failed to complete an anger management course that had been recommended for him. That was one of the factors cited that I recall off the top of my head. He continues to have problems with disciplinary infractions, and that under the D.C. guidelines continues to make him an unsuitable for parole in the mind of the parole commission.
Okay.
Can I ask two quick follow-up questions on absolute immunity? One is the Supreme Court has said we should look to common law immunities, and at common law, or at least in the development of our history, governors were responsible for parole and commutation, but did not have absolute immunity, correct? And even today, I don't think the people in that kind of position in the states have absolute immunity who are involved in these decisions.
I believe they have immunity from 1983 actions.
Absolute.
I don't know. Are there any cases about... a governor who declines to provide parole or release the prisoner can be sued? Are there any cases one way or the other? I don't know.
I believe that some of the cases we've cited in our brief at between 21 and 23 deal with state officials. For example, Brown versus California Department of Corrections affords absolute immunity to state parole officials. Mm-hmm.
Or in an independent position.
Well, we're back to that.
Yes.
I would note that the Brown...
That's actually unclear when I'll grant you when they refer to it in Clevenger and they refer back to Morrissey. Can you try to figure out how the officials in Morrissey were appointed or are removable, which is more important? It's a little murky. So.
Yeah, and the concept of being independent is sort of an interesting one. It can be applied to be independent from everything and anything. And
well, in this context, I think it does mean independent from political pressure, and that traditionally is equated to not being removable at will.
I think, as I've made clear, I respectfully disagree with you. If there are no further questions, I would ask the decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Keller, we ran his time out, right? We'll give you another 2 minutes, Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to make a couple of brief points. First, to backtrack with Judge Kavanaugh's question about why this independence is so important. And my sense is why the Supreme Court is focused on it is that the idea that if you have an independent adjudicator who's going to be reviewed through some sort of internal system of appellate review, they're more likely to follow the law, and they're less likely to need the threat of personal liability to do what they're supposed to do. And if you have non-independent adjudicators adjudicating disputes without any sort of meaningful appellate review, they're more likely not to follow the law. And that's why I think here it is important that commissioners have that threat of potentially personal liability for their constitutional wrongs. Second, about qualified immunity, I do think it's important to remember that we're at the motion to dismiss stage, and at least with respect to whether Mr. Taylor's allegations rise to the level of an ex post facto violation, all he has to do is establish a plausible claim that there's a risk, not that he would have been released, but there was a risk that he would be in prison longer. And I think, particularly in light of the West Virginia court opinion, he's met that low burden. The court has no further questions.
Is the test a risk or a significant risk?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's a significant risk.
Seeing none, we'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you very much, Mr. Keller. You were appointed by the court to represent the amicus for the court in this case, and the court's grateful for your participation.
Thank you.